Let us meet a remarkable woman, a medieval professor of medicine. Two people will bring her to life for you. Stage and TV actress Megan Cole is a visiting faculty member at the University of Texas Medical School. When she quotes medical advice, she speaks in the medieval woman's own words, based on old writings. The rest of her dialogue is educated invention. John Leinhard, who writes and hosts The Engines of Our Ingenuity, provides a narrative framework. Imagine, then, you sit in two classrooms. John speaks to you in a present-day lecture hall, but when you hear Megan's voice, you're shifted in both time and space. You're now in a small outdoor meeting place in Salerno, Italy. We're not sure of the actual date, but it's close to 1200 AD.
In 1544, one Georg Kraut of Strasbourg published the first printed version of a medical text with the title The Never-Before-Published Book of Trotula, on curing the ailments of women before, during, and after birth. What Kraut had done was to assemble a set of three manuscripts that had been traveling together since they first turned up in Salerno, Italy, around the 12th century. He and others before him had called the collection the Trotula, after the woman they credited with writing it.
My name is Trocta. The people around here don't seem to be familiar with the name Trocta. They pronounce it as Trotta. And then they have the nerve to call my writings the Little Trotta, Trotula, for God's sake. Anyway, I'm here to teach you what I know about medicine for women.
Historian Monica Green recently translated the Trotula into English, and she added her own 80-page commentary. High time someone did. This work has troubled historians for centuries. The three books that make it up deal with the conditions of women, the treatment of women, and women's cosmetics. Green believes that Trocta adapted the material on conditions and cosmetics from older works, but that the book on treatments, that was her original contribution. But you and I won't worry about which ideas were hers and which were older, for ideas always swirl and flow among many people. What is important was that Trocta gave medieval Europe its most important work on women's medicine. She's the earliest identifiable female professor of medicine, and Salerno, where she taught, was then the center of medical learning in Europe. What is important is that this collection was clearly the basis for her teaching.
Now, my aspirants, as you undertake your studies, I commend three books to you. You must read all three as you try to become healers of women. These manuscripts, on women's conditions, on treating women, and on cosmetics, are all in the care of my servant. You will make arrangements with her to read them.
Medicine was a strange mishmash in the 12th century. The old works of Galen and Hippocrates had been reworked by later Greeks and Romans. Then they'd been picked up, studied, and added to by Arab physicians. Remedies that varied all the way from superstition to solid empiricism both diluted and improved upon the old works. And Salerno made the ideal mixing pot for this stew of medieval medicine. Salerno and the rest of southern Italy lay outside the Holy Roman Roman Empire. It was part of the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. Rome looked north to Europe. Salerno was truly Mediterranean. The city was deeply involved in trade with the Muslim world, and it was wonderfully cosmopolitan. Christians, Jews, and Muslims, German Lombards, African traders, they all swirled through its streets. One oddity of Salerno was that it had been invaded and conquered by Normans not too long after the Battle of Hastings. Now, a century later, those Normans were still the ruling class. But the texture of southern Italy was formed out of Mediterranean influences.
Those Muslim women! They cover themselves and display themselves at the same time. How do they do it? Well, it's subtle. Eyeshadow, the hang of their garments. And the Christian women imitate them. They go about on the feast day of Christmas wrapped in elegant cloaks, concealed by colored veils, shod with gilt slippers. They parade off to their churches with Muslim jewelry, henna on their fingers, wearing all the perfumes of Araby. Now, you young pups out there, if you hope to learn medicine, you must know some of what is written on cosmetics. Now, listen to this. An ointment for noble women which removes hairs, refines the skin, and takes away blemishes. Take juice of the leaves of squirting cucumber and almond milk, gently mixed with quicklime and orpiment, to which has been added an equal amount each of mastic, frankincense, cinnamon, nutmeg, and clove. This ointment smells sweetly, and Salernitan and noble women are accustomed to it. When the woman has anointed herself all over with this depilatory, let her sit in a very hot steam bath, but she should not rub herself, because her limbs will be excoriated. But when she has stayed there a little while, try to pull out the hairs from the pubic area. If they do not fall out easily, let her have hot water be poured over her, and let her wash herself all over, drawing her palm over her skin very gently. And after several other treatments with bran, henna, and whites of eggs, followed by various rinsings with warm water, finally, with a very white linen cloth wrapped around her, let her go to bed.
I need to explain a few things about the Trotula. First of all, Baghdad had been the intellectual center of the world since the 8th century. The Arabs had carefully studied the medicine of Hippocrates and Galen. Then they'd advanced it in many ways. Europe was just undergoing its own rebirth, and that meant looking to Baghdad for ideas and for knowledge. And what about the notion that a woman had emerged here as a noted doctor and medical educator? A couple of points. Medicine included four canonical areas that had long been identified with women. The set included gynecology, midwifery, cosmetics, and skin diseases. Women were involved with these areas of medicine, but usually in what we would call paramedical roles. A woman might be a midwife or in charge of caring for a recovering patient. Tracta also limited herself to the standard areas of women's medicine, but she emerged as a major writer and codifier of these arts. That was pretty singular, even in the high-rolling liberal world of 12th century Europe. Although Tracta was sticking her neck out pretty far, she kept the classical scientific underpinnings of medicine clearly in focus.
Now, my apprentices, you've all studied how the ancient principles of earth, air, fire, and water are affected by the action of hot and cold, and of dampness and dryness. You must now learn how these actions also determine transmutations in the body of a woman. Listen. God, the creator of the universe, endowed human nature above all other things with a singular dignity, giving to it, above the condition of all other animals, freedom of reason and intellect. And wishing to sustain its generation in perpetuity, he created the male and the female with provident dispensing deliberation, laying out in the separate sexes the foundation for the propagation of future offspring. And so that from them there might emerge fertile offspring, he endowed their complexions with a certain pleasing commixtion, constituting the nature of the male hot and dry. But lest the male overflow with either one of these qualities, he wished by the opposing frigidity and humidity of the woman to rein him in from too much excess, so that the stronger qualities, that is, the heat and the dryness, should rule the man, who is the stronger and more worthy person, while the weaker ones, that is to say, the coldness and humidity, should rule the weaker person, that is, the woman. Therefore, because women are by nature weaker than men, and... please, let me interrupt here for a moment. You will remember that this older book was written by a man. Yes? Well, we continue. Because women are by nature weaker than men, and because they are most frequently afflicted in childbirth, diseases very often abound in them, especially around the organs devoted to the work of nature. Moreover, women, from the condition of their fragility, out of shame and embarrassment, do not dare reveal their anguish over the diseases, which happen in such a private place, to a physician. Therefore, their misfortune, which ought to be pitied, and especially the influence of a certain woman stirring my heart, have impelled me, with God's help, to give a clear explanation of the causes of their diseases, their symptoms, and their cures.
Most of Trotta's cures were herbal. Surgery was the work of a lower class than that of a physician. It was certainly a pretty small part of Hippocratic medicine. Take the matter of sutures. The Greeks had used them sparingly. They were dangerous in a septic world, unequipped with antibiotics. Hippocratic doctors were far better at fancy bandaging than they were at stitching. The only doctors who got away with suturing before the late 19th century were ones who'd perfected means for keeping the sutures reasonably clean.
On the dangerous things happening to women giving birth. There are some women for whom things go wrong in giving birth, and this is kept hidden by the women. For there are some women in whom the vagina and the anus become one opening and the same pathway, whence in these women the womb comes out of the body and hardens. We give aid to such women by repositioning the womb. We put on the womb warm wine, in which butter has been boiled, and diligently we foment it until the womb has been rendered soft, and then we gently replace it. Afterward, we sew the rupture between the anus and the vagina in three or four places with a silk thread. Then we place a linen cloth into the vagina to fill it completely. Then let us smear the vagina with liquid pitch. This makes the womb withdraw because of its stench. And we heal the rupture with a powder made of comfrey, that is, of bruisewort and daisy and cumin. The powder ought to be sprinkled on the wound, and the woman should be placed in bed so that her feet are higher than the rest of her body, and there let her do all her business for 8 or 9 days.
Trotta's writings on the philosophy of medicine become very interesting when she takes up older ideas and then improves upon them.
Now, my acolytes, listen first to what has been passed down to us by ancient doctors in their book on cosmetics. On fissures of the lips, that is to say, splitting of the lips. Fissures of the lips are removed by anointing them thoroughly with rose oil or linseed cooked in a hollowed-out sow bread. And also they should be smeared with saxifrage seed, pounded with juice of common centaury or with round birthwort. Juice of wormwood is good for the same. Well, my acolytes, what they say here is all well and good, but it hardly fits with the modern pharmacopoeia in this 12th century after our Lord's birth. Nor does it take proper account of causes, for to talk about any infirmity apart from its cause is to underestimate it. Therefore, I say to you this about splitting when it occurs in the lips. There are some women who suffer from fissures of the lips, and this on account of the excessive embraces of their lovers, and their kisses on their lips rubbing between them. You see, cause. For in the morning their lips are found to be cracked, dried by the heat. We treat these women with an ointment made of fleawort, or with an unguent made from lily.
Trotta also had a great deal to say about the sea of nasty little problems that infested a still pretty dirty world.
On foul-smelling sweat. There are some women who have sweat that stinks beyond measure. For these we prepare cloth dipped in wine, in which there have been boiled leaves of bilberry, or the herb itself, or the bilberries themselves. For extracting the worm from the hands and the feet, that is to say, the itch mite, take a heated brick and any kind of vessel full of water, and afterward let henbane seed be placed upon the burning brick, and let the patient hold her feet above the smoke, and you will see the worms falling into the water just like hairs. Likewise for worm of the ears. Take an apple and hollow it out and place it on the ear, and if there is any worm, it will come out. For swelling of the testicles, a fomentation. Take marshmallow, wormwood, vervain, henbane, mugwort, and cabbages. Let all these be cooked in strong or old wine, and then foment the testicles 2 or 3 times a day. There are many other conditions that deserve our attention, and at our next meeting we will address hemorrhoids, scabies, and corroded or rotted gums. Possess your souls in patience.
We might wonder why Trachte devotes so much time to these matters when her prime focus was clearly upon all the complexities of human reproduction. Actually, there's a lot of subtext here. Both surgery and midwifery were pretty low-class occupations in the medieval medical world. Trachte was an academic physician. As such, she dealt with the iatrochemistry, or the alchemy of healing. So there's a clear dimension of camouflage within her writings. She was obviously defining her status as a physician, and she was making herself marketable to the upper classes. Underneath, however, she was solidly focused
on... But I've told you enough about these afflictions. Your work, above all else, is to see women in their travails, which are so uniquely theirs. The Lord spoke to Eve and said, I shall greatly multiply your sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow shalt thou bring forth children. Well, I tell you, I stand between the good Lord and any woman giving birth. And the best you unformed whelps can do, as you studied birthing, is to read these pages of which I speak. The basics are there. You will read them carefully.
Later readers of the Trotula in a more masculine age had trouble with the frankness of its discussions of the causes of infertility. The idea that a male might be the infertile partner was not popular in the 12th century.
There are some women who are useless for conception, either because they are too lean and thin, or because they are too fat, and the flesh surrounding the orifice of the womb constricts it, and it does not permit the seed of the man to enter into the womb. Some women also have a womb so slippery and smooth that the seed, once it has been received, is not able to be retained inside. But sometimes this also happens by fault of the man, who has excessively thin seed, which, poured into the womb, because of its liquidity, slips outside. Some men indeed have extremely cold and dry testicles. These men rarely or never generate, because their seed is useless for generation. Indeed, conception is impeded as much by the fault of the man as by the fault of the woman. Now, either this comes about from a defect of the spirit impelling the seed, or from a defect of spermatic humidity, or from a defect of heat. If from a defect of heat, he will not desire intercourse. Whence it is necessary in such men to anoint the loins with aragon, or take rocket seed and spurge, and reduce them into a fine powder, and you should mix these with musk oil and pennyroyal oil and anoint the loins. But if it happens from defect of the spirits, he will again have no desire, and he will not be able to attain an erection. Well, we aid him with an unguent generative of many spirits. And if it is because of a defect of the seed, when they have intercourse, they emit little or no semen. We help men such as this with substances which augment and generate seed, such as onions, parsnips, and similar things.
The book on the conditions of women gives us a remarkably accurate picture of the process that runs between conception and birth. She clearly saw both the process and its implications with stunning clarity.
Galen reports that the fetus is attached to the womb just like fruit to a tree, which, when it proceeds from the flower, is extremely delicate and is destroyed by any sort of accident. But when it has grown and become a little mature and adheres firmly to the tree, it will not be destroyed by any minor accident. And when it is thoroughly mature, it will not be destroyed by any mishap at all. So it is when at first the infant is brought out from the conceived seed, for its ligaments with which it is tied to the womb are thin and not solid, and from a slight accident it is ejected through miscarriage. Whence a woman, on account of coughing and diarrhea, or dysentery, or excessive motion, or anger, or bloodletting, can loose the fetus. But when the soul is infused into the child, it adheres a little more firmly and does not slip out so quickly. And when the child has matured, it is led out quickly by the function of nature. For when the time of birth has arrived, the child moves itself vehemently, and it exerts itself towards its egress, when, in its own time, nature makes the vagina open so that the fetus finds liberty of its exit. And so the fetus is expelled from its bed, that is to say, the afterbirth, by the force of nature. Further, here is our thinking on how the embryo develops. In the first month there is purgation of the blood. In the second month there is expression of the blood and the body. In the third month the fetus produces nails and hair. In the fourth month it begins to move, and for that reason women are nauseated. In the fifth month, the fetus takes on the likeness of its father or its mother. In the sixth month, the nerves are constituted. In the seventh month, the fetus solidifies its bones and nerves. In the eighth month, nature moves, and the infant is made complete in the blessing of all its parts. And in the ninth month, it proceeds from the darkness into the light.
Of course, then as now, abortion was widely practiced and widely abhorred, but there was a ground rule that the Christian world had adopted from Islam. It was that abortion was not a mortal sin if it took place before the child's soul had been formed. That was taken to be the period up to what Trakta would have called the quickening. The quickening was the mother's ability to discern the baby's separate life within her. So Trakta and the medieval world around her believed exactly what the U.S. Supreme Court decided in 1973, that abortion should be a matter between a woman and her physician during the first trimester. Still, doctors who practiced abortions often encoded what they were up to, just as they've done ever since. Inducing abortion, for example, often masqueraded as curing menstrual irregularity.
If the menses have been deficient for a long time, take 2 drams of rhubarb, 1 dram each of dry mugwort and pepper, and let there be made a powder, and let her drink it morning and evening for 3 days, and let her cover herself so that she sweats. Likewise, take tansy, clover, and mugwort, fry in butter made in May, and place upon the navel. A certain physician made this in the region of France. Take ginger, laurel leaves, and savin, pound them and place them together in a plain pot on live coals, and let the woman sit upon a perforated seat, and let her receive the smoke through the lower members, and thus the menses will return. Let this be done 3 or 4 times, or even more often. But for the woman who frequently makes applications of this kind, it is necessary that she anoint her vagina inside with cold unguents, lest she become excessively heated.
An insistence upon being a virgin when you married was much stronger then. So, what of the young lady who entered into marriage having previously had sexual intercourse?
A good constrictive for the vagina so that they appear as if they were virgins. Take the whites of eggs and mix them with water in which pennyroyal and hot herbs of this kind have been cooked, and with a new linen cloth dipped in it, place it in the vagina 2 or 3 times a day. And if she urinates at night, put it in again. Of course, remove all these things before the hour of the commencement of intercourse. Likewise, take powder of natron or blackberry and put it in. It constricts the vagina marvelously. Likewise, there are some dirty and corrupt prostitutes who desire to seem to be more than virgins, and they make a constrictive for this purpose, but they are ill-counseled, in that for their constrictive they take powdered natron and powdered glass and place it in the vagina, and thereby render themselves bloody and wound the penis of the man. What is better is if the following is done 1 night before the woman is married. Let her place leeches in the vagina, but take care that they do not go in too far, so that blood comes out and is converted into a little clot, and thus the man will be deceived by the effusion of blood.
Now, we can put Trakta in perspective by looking at medical writings from the late 19th century here in America. For example, in an 1887 book titled The Medical Genius, a Dr. Stacy Jones organizes an encyclopedia of remedies by agents. He begins with acacia, then aconite, then alcohol. He recommends alcohol for sore throat, itch, tooth decay, bed sores, angina, and spotted fever. The bees include belladonna. Cabbage will draw the infection from a wound, and chloride of chromium will cure external cancers. Coffee grounds sprinkled on live coals clear out atmospheric impurities. Certain pains can be allayed with tea made from live honeybees. We have myrrh for a sore throat and opium for puerperal fever. We find pepsin, potash, silica, silver, and starch. When the alphabet runs out, a section tells us that electromagnetism cures headache, delirium, baldness, deafness, pneumonia, cancer, and it helps broken bones to knit. And all this really did represent the state of medicine in America just over a century ago. Yet that was not very different from Trakta's practice. In fact, I think I see the thread of common sense more clearly in Trakta's writings than I do in Jones's. What really separates Jones and Trakta from medicine today are better techniques for organizing clinical experience, publishing it, testing it, doing far more careful winnowing. But now as then, experience was where we looked to validate medicine. Historians have gone around and around about Trakta. Victorian scholars doubted that a woman could ever speak with such frankness, that the author must have been male. Most scholars today now agree that Trakta was indeed a woman, a remarkable woman, and that much of the writing was original with her. So I suspect that the women of Salerno truly were in pretty good hands.
Well, that's enough for today. One last word for you aspirants, and it's this. Do not be content to do your procedures as if in secret. Let the patient know that healing is taking place and that God is present in it. Even in such a simple procedure as cutting a child's umbilical cord, you should say as follows, holding the stump extended, Jesus Christ is dead. He was pierced by the lance, and he took no thought of any ointment or of his pain or of any unguent. But first you should tie the umbilical cord, and afterward, having said this charm, wrap it with a string of an instrument that is plucked or bowed, or some other musical instrument. So, at our next meeting, we'll talk more about the importance of cleanliness, and we'll take up diseases of the skin. You have your work to do, and I... Well... Salerno is such a beautiful place, spreading down along the side of a hill. And I have a special treat in store for me on this particular day. The nuns of San Giorgio have built a bathhouse on the hill, and this is the day that I go there with the men and women of Salerno to bathe. Oh, it's so lovely in the late autumn afternoons, looking out over the Tyrrhenian Sea. You'll soon forget the things I'm telling you. I know. But the sun setting out there beyond the water, that at least will still be there 1,000 years from now.